Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource graciously supported through contributions by our listeners. To find out more about our program and how you can help, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com or stick around to the end for more information. Now, on with the show. Welcome to episode 127, where we discuss an article from Mark Granovetter titled Economic Action and Social Structure, The Problem of Embeddedness, published in the American Journal of Sociology in 1985. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com.
Hi, this is Sarah from London.
Hi, this is Rohan, also from London.
And this is Tom from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States. So welcome. And today we're going to do our second episode on articles from Mark Granovetter. And unlike perhaps some of the other authors that we've done two articles of where the articles were very, very closely related to each other, this one is a marked different piece from what we did in episode 86 on networks and network theory when we covered one of Granovetter's articles then. This time, we're now going to get into his work in economic sociology, which has been a running theme for the past 12 months. We've had a couple of episodes on economic sociology in recent times, and this furthers it. So we're covering an article from the American Journal of Sociology, Economic Action and Social Structure, The Problem of Embeddedness. And I'll just introduce the article and just kind of say, you know, this is very, very different from the other work that we did on Granovetter. This one is tackling a very thorny issue that was present in 1985. And I guess the best way to put it, or a way to put it, is that Granovetter recognized two camps operating at extremes of each other when it came to the connections between social structure and economic action. And he was presenting this article to say that both extreme perspectives were not correct. So at one end, you have sort of the utilitarian view, in which says that as economic people, everybody is rational, everybody follows their self-interests, and success in economic activity is all driven by this unpersoning of the actions. So it's basically competition is what breeds the best economic actions, and social action or social relationships really have no play. And then at the opposite side, which was the view that social action is the primary driver of economic behavior, that it latched onto a view that in the days before industrialization, everything was about social relationships when it came to trade, when it came to other things. It was all about who you knew and your own tiny little network. And so it was a strongly connected network. And that was what drove economic action. What Granovetter was doing was basically exposing the weaknesses of both extremes, and said that, if you follow those two views to their logical conclusion, it doesn't match at all what we see in practice. And so what he tried to do is to talk about or present embeddedness as something where social structures and social relationships are so interdependent with economic action that it's like you can't treat them as separate. So with that, let me open the floor and get your initial reactions to this, because this was a very challenging article to read, in my view.
There's also a third part of the triangle. So it's not just A versus B that's presented. Then he draws an explicit criticism or critique of Oliver Williamson's Markets and Hierarchies research program. I mean, that is even in the abstract. It says, I'm going to deliver this A versus B battle, and at the same time, I'm going to critique this person's entire research program. So there is a third piece to be discussed that's not just sort of economics versus sociology that created a birth of economic sociology. We have this third piece as well. And the other thing that struck me in your introduction, Tom, was I thought you were going to talk about this paper situated in the social phenomena of 1985, namely sort of organized crime and corruption. Because that is one of the examples that he draws, and it was a very big problem in the cities that were being studied. I mean, he was writing this from New York. The Chicago School of Sociology had this problem as well. And looking at these sources and solutions to crime and the rise of crime in the 80s. So I actually thought that's what you were going to say when you said he was responding to an episode of its time, not just the academic debate. So I would just also flag that this is a bit more than 10 years after the other paper. 12 years apart in publishing. We know there's a long arm or a long tail to things getting published, so we can't be sure exactly how much time has passed. And it's, in my reading of it, it's more that instead of it's not a complete change of program from networks. It's talking about networks as a type of concrete personal relations and structures of such relations that generate the good and the bad, the trust, what he calls generating trust and discouraging malfeasance. So it's that, and it also comes right after Akerlof, which is the market for lemons, or as the way it's summarized here, the origins of honesty, which I've never heard the famous Akerlof model be described as origins of honesty. And I think, oh, what if we thought of all of these canonical papers with a different subtitle to them, right? So anyway, those two things I think are really important to understand in how this fits in Granovetter's canon of works, but how this fits with what else is going on in economics and society at the time.
And then I guess kind of grandiose backdrop to all of this is how it fits in kind of social thought. And this being an AJS piece, he starts it also kind of very abstract, and he keeps returning to two particular thinkers from, one is 1600s, the other 1700s, Thomas Hobbes and Adam Smith. And so along with kind of, if you think of the key question is kind of how to explain or account for social behavior, the other side of it that he's interested in is ultimately social order. And so let's say in the case of Hobbes, one view, social order comes from this implicit social contract. And so you need this kind of a universal internalized social contract. And it's very interesting, we'll come to later, how he actually thinks these two views kind of join each other full circle at a certain point. But on the other hand, Adam Smith, for him, order comes from competition. And so Granovetter refers to this as an atomized or atomistic utilitarian view. And so then the kind of philosophical backdrop is this atomistic utilitarian view of let agents do what they do, and then order is emergent from competition, and the Hobbesian kind of authority and, you know, the Leviathan view of order comes from a social contract that everyone subscribes to and obeys. So it comes from obedience rather than competition, you could say. And then to the point that both of you were making, Tom and Sarah, Granovetter's agenda in this paper is, one is a rich description of these two sides, and then he offers what he believes is a third way, which links closely to his kind of social network approach. And the third way is kind of a middle path. In fact, at one point, he literally says it threads through the under-socialized and over-socialized views. But just to dwell a bit more on that, what the initial, the battle is, as you put it, Sarah. The battle on the one hand is that atomized view, and on the other hand is embeddedness. And this actually, I was a bit confused about coming into it. But embeddedness is something that he's drawing on an older paper by a sociologist, Dennis Wrong, who talks about the over-socialized concept of man. And the idea is that embeddedness is a problem because it assumes almost this monolithic kind of internalized universal set of norms, and people just all act based on those norms. So it's ironically atomized once again, because you aren't behaving based on your pattern of relationships, but rather on this universal social contract. And if we have to kind of name something, what's the opposite problem to the problem of embeddedness is the problem of atomism, or of disembeddedness, where there's no kind of social contract, or rather, as he points out in his introduction, when he talks about new institutional economists, you even start to, perhaps in a perverse way, derive the social contracts from economic solutions to economic problems. And so you start analyzing those as what he calls, social stuff as an epiphenomenon of the economics. And so, correct, there's this kind of pitched battle between the fully embedded view, the fully disembedded view, and then he tries to kind of thread a line in between.
For the record, though, the battle framework is not mine. That comes in a short distance. It comes from the article itself, where on pages 492 to 3, he says, most extended and large-scale disorder results from coalitions of combatants, impossible without prior relations. We do not generally speak of war unless actors have arranged themselves into two sides as the end result of various coalitions. And that language and framework comes from, as Rowan said, the Hobbesian perspective, this sort of taming the natives or taming our wild individual preferences in order to organize ourselves into society. So just to be clear, I am running with the author's framework there. I did not want to poke Tom's, the definition of war is, but actually, if you think of the episode we did on the art of war, it wasn't only applicable to bloody combat either, right? That was the whole point of us doing that episode, was the art of war was about a lot of interpersonal politics, social relations, things that happen inside organizations. So I think this is just another in our list of using war as an example, right, Tom?
Yes, and that was a case of how you think about winning without fighting. You know, the metaphor does apply, you know, as you think about the way in which he presents the connection between economic action and social structures here. I admit that because this is my first reading of the article, it didn't immediately, you know, come to mind that the discussions about corruption and those sorts of activities was at the heart of the article, because it's not the way that he wrote it, naturally, because this is an AJS article and you've got to lay the theoretical groundwork first. And so I didn't take the practical as like the first thing that drew my attention. But you're absolutely right. Once you get past setting up this triangle, and now this is where I think some unpacking of the article is kind of necessary, because this is a case of terms that I think we all kind of know what they mean, but there's many different meanings of them. And so I sort of went in and, for example, trust is one of those terms that a lot of people use, and we all know that it's sort of like a universal good thing. But what does it actually mean? And so I like to draw from an article that a colleague of mine wrote 12 years ago, where it's got like several components to it. So, and I think it's consistent with what he's talking about in terms of trust. Credibility of competence, benevolence of motives, integrity with a sense of fairness and honesty, and predictability of behavior. So we're talking about trust, and then malfeasance is where we're talking about illegal actions where it's knowingly done, acting beyond the scope of given authorities, and it causes harm to public or to a legal order. There you go. You've got some ready definitions to understand what we're talking about with corruption, why he is pursuing that as like the context in which he's trying to build this argument, because it is something that has long been a part of economic life, the notions of trust and malfeasance. Why does it persist despite these, you know, these atomized explanations of how things should work and what should dampen malfeasance and maintain order?
So my scholarship has long had a lens to it of social evaluations. We've talked before about how I work on status and status recognition, especially things like prizes and awards. But before I completely focused on status as well, I was studying reputation. And I spent a few years at the Center for Corporate Reputation at SAED at Oxford. And reputation at the time was dominated by economists. And the idea was that you could not have reputation until you'd had a first transaction. And then you built reputation through a series of successful transactions, successful for both sides, or in general, just not doing a bad deal to the other side. So essentially your reputation of doing nothing or doing something positive, as long as there wasn't anything negative on your record. And I spend a lot of time trying to work up a theory of whether you really do start from zero. And I found myself, it's a much longer discussion we can have another episode on, because I think social evaluations as a mezzo set of constructs would be really valuable to this audience. And I know that Pedro has some thoughts in that space as well. But the difference was always, economists say you start from zero, you earn up the positive through a series of successful interactions. And if your first interaction is negative, then the relationship ends, right? You would never go below zero because a negative interaction would just stop that relationship. It would be inefficient or ineffective for the parties to go back and give you, there's no second chances in economics, right? Whereas then in sociology, the default was whether you would start from, let's say, a perfect 100. The assumption that, call them institutions, call them norms, call them embeddedness, or as Hobbes would say, just wanting to be in society and not be expelled, which is the ultimate punishment, right? Being expelled outside the gates, is enough to keep people trading properly. So you would start at a very positive reputation. You could take some dings to it, and it would be relative to other people, but in general, it's yours to lose, is the social perspective on it. And even though I spent a lot of time trying to get these two sides to speak to each other, I never got to embeddedness as the answer. Or certainly this space of economic sociology in the middle seemed like a fine place to play, but still didn't have an ultimate answer to it. And I wonder, as we go through this article today, in this push-pull that he describes as a war, or war between two sides that result from various coalitions, whether we will get to an answer today either.
So, I mean, I do think Granovetter is trying to get us an answer to that. And the way he's kind of structured it is, once he's set up the battle and the players, and also perhaps it's worth mentioning at this point, part of the setup, he talks about in anthropology as well, a substantivist versus a formalist school. And so the substantivist school would be similar to the kind of over-socialized side of it, and the formalist would be similar to the economics side of it. And I guess another important thing just in the introduction is the way he's harnessing a lot of these different ideas, whether it's from anthropology, sociology, economics, polyscience, these philosophers like Hobbes and Smith, is indicative of his background, which he did his grad school in Harvard's Department of Social Relations. And he has, I was watching a video of him on YouTube accepting an award. And he talks about how it has since been dissolved, but in the 60s, that was similar to what we think of when we think of the Carnegie School. Harvard's Department of Social Relations was a very interdisciplinary program. And so part of his grad school involved courses in everything from sociology to clinical psychology. And having heard that bit of his talk, his kind of award acceptance talk, and then revisiting this introduction, it was evident to me that he's drawing on all these things because he's read quite widely. Now, he then tries two ways in this paper to operationalize his suggestion of a third way. And the second bit, which we'll come to later, is what you were saying, Sarah, where he's kind of critiquing the transaction cost view and suggesting what his alternate approach would imply if one were to use that analysis. In the first part, he's trying to answer this question of trust and malfeasance, using, again, it's a way to operationalize his idea of this third path. And so the fundamental question in this section of the paper is, and I quote from page 488, the classical problem of how it can be that daily economic life is not riddled with mistrust and malfeasance. So the question is, how come we don't see this every day? Like, how come the dominant thing around us is not mistrust and malfeasance? The answer from the over-socialized, or rather, let's start with, he starts with the under-socialized answer to that question of why is life not rife with fraud and malfeasance? The under-socialized answer is institutional arrangements. And so the idea there is, we've got kind of sanctioning, we've got contracts, we've got things that have emerged as a substitute for trust. So it's not actually giving you the answer of why we trust each other. It's rather saying, here's a substitute for why we all behave in ways that lead to a trustworthy order. And he attributes that argument to the new institutional economists. And then the over-socialized view is that there's just a generalized universal morality. Again, similar to the under-socialized view, we are acting atomistically. It doesn't matter who my friends are or what my pattern of social relations is, but I live in this society. And so based on that, I don't commit fraud. I don't perpetrate malfeasance. And then he brings out kind of his view, which is that it actually matters what the patterns of social relations are. And that helps to explain why we don't see fraud and malfeasance. It also helps to explain why sometimes we do see, and he talks about sometimes the largest scale fraud and malfeasance involves successful patterns of social relations coordinating to colluding to defraud society, for example. And then so the benefit of his third path is kind of it captures a bit more of reality.
Yes. And I like the example that he gave at the top of page 490 of, just to give a sense of the generalized morality and then showing where it where that view sort of falls short. He uses the example of tipping, especially tipping at a place where, like, if you're a traveler and you're going to a place that you've never been to before. Okay. So why do you go along with tipping? And what he says is that, taken to a logical extreme, this is something that would just make no sense. The you and the restaurant don't know each other. You're never going to see each other again. And there's not likelihood of any connection back to anyone, connected to each other who would know if and whether or not you actually tipped. Now, this, of course, is 1985, before social media, where knowledge of one's individual actions has changed a bit, but never mind. So what he offers is three explanations about why it is that social relations may indeed often be a necessary condition for trust and trustworthy behavior, but they're not sufficient to guarantee these and may even provide occasion and means for malfeasance. So following on with what you said, Rowan, the first item was the trust engendered by personal relations presents by its very existence enhanced opportunity for malfeasance, which means that if you are a closed, strongly connected network of people and you all trust each other, you are likely to basically bend the rules for the benefit of those within your little network and disregard perhaps what's on the outside. That was my take. The second point was force and fraud are most efficiently pursued by teams, which I think sort of speaks to if you're outside of that closed-in circle. Well, it's a lot easier to get away with it with a closed network of like-minded individuals than it is, say, if you're an individual on your own, because if you're an individual on your own committing malfeasance, you can be identified and squashed, would be sort of like the argument, I guess. And the extent of disorder resulting from force and fraud depends very much on how the network of social relations is structured, which is like what's the harm that is caused depends on how any malfeasance affects the network, is sort of my take. Does that jive with your understanding?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if you think of Granovetter's whole kind of the thing that he's repeating throughout the paper is that, look, folks, economic action is neither as over-socialized as some people say, nor as under-socialized as others say. So Tom, what you pointed out is him saying, if it was so over-socialized that there's this generalized social morality, a contract we all buy into as seen in the example of tipping, then we shouldn't see things like Ponzi schemes or insider trading or kind of people embezzling entire kind of companies or bribing, which among nations, which might be in the news recently. And the examples you talked about are him knocking down that over-socialized. Because if over-socialized were true and there is this universal morality, then you wouldn't see these patterns, but these patterns you would see if instead kind of behavior depends on subsections of social relations. Similarly, earlier on in page 490, he knocks down the under-socialized view, saying that an under-socialized view might be that, let's say I want to do business with someone, the economist would say, well, this person, and this is Sarah's point and her research as well, or rather the research that she was trying to bridge across, the economist might say, it just depends on the person's reputation. If they have a good reputation, you'll work with them. And what Granovetter says in page 490 in the second paragraph is, in practice, we settle for such generalized information when nothing better is available, but ordinarily we seek better information. So better, and I quote, better than the statement that someone is known to be reliable, which is the economist's view, is better than that, is information from a trusted informant that he has dealt with that individual and found him so. So I'd rather than just knowing someone's reputation through a Trustpilot review or something like that, I would prefer word of mouth through my own network and my own kind of pattern of social relations. And hence that knocks down the under-socialized view as well. And as always, he's arguing for this kind of thread in between.
The one thing that I struggled with was, so you can accept those three examples or you can accept those three points. In the initial introduction, there isn't as many case examples to lean on as I would like to. So I think we're agreed about the trust and reputation one. And the main example that's used is about diamond dealing, which still is very much done on family and extended network connections, verbal or handshake contracts rather than documentation. And so the diamond example is fine. The extension he then attempts to use about like finger pointing in criminal gangs or murder rings, and which clearly were a sort of local example to the time of finishing or writing the paper. I'm sure we've all had that experience where you put in a note to self that said, add real life example here. And then you sit down and think of, you know, what's in the news. Some of those are where I struggle. It's not enough to invalidate the theory, but it's not also enough to settle it. So, for example, he extends one of the principles to fleeing a burning building, right? And the economists would say everyone's acting rationally because it's a prisoner's dilemma, that we know that we should walk calmly to our nearest signposted exit, taking nothing with you, which is what they say on the airplane. And yet that relies on everyone else also walking calmly, or you're the one person walking calmly and getting trampled while everyone else is running away from the danger. So that is the point where he says that, oh, if we were all tightly structured like a family unit and the fire were in our house, nobody tramples their family in a house fire and everyone gets out okay. I have problems with that example, and I also don't think it helps us illustrate the point, which is the point he summarizes it on 491 as you always hurt the one you love. I also have issues with that as an example. So I think we actually probably need to walk through some of these a little more. But I understood the three points that Rowan was bringing up as the examples of when do you need formal institutions and when are informal relationships enough? And that's a question we've brought up on this series a number of times. We've had a couple of papers on institutional theory. We had an episode on economic sociology specifically talking about institutions. And that is generally where most of us encounter Leviathan for the first time, is in trying to look at when do you need institutions such as the law. So that's where I got it from, moral reasoning at Harvard. Thank you, Rowan. The first time I read through it was in moral reasoning as a distribution requirement, then the then instantiation of that social issues program. And that's when do you need law and contracts and punishments, and when is social relations enough, or when, as the economist would say, is the sort of cost benefit to the individual analysis what works? And that's where we get the Leviathan from. And the difference here, or what I've written down as when we move from, is that talking about essentially culture as an institution. So that was a end of paragraph summary on page 486. It says, more sophisticated and thus less over-socialized analyses of cultural influences make it clear that culture is not a once and for all influence, but an ongoing process, continuously constructed and reconstructed during interaction. It not only shapes its members, but also is shaped by them in part for their own strategic reasons. I understand that as, in a way, active gardening of institutions. So culture now, this is a small argument in a bigger paper that sets the ground for culture as an institution. And that, I think, is a very helpful way of understanding what are the three options. But it's then not taken up much more, I think, in the rest of the paper. So I suppose that's one of those ones that if we were writing, we would pull it out as future research should expand on, because it wasn't the main thrust here.
Yeah, I mean, that actually sparked an interesting thought. Well, interesting to me, and hopefully you both agree that this, and particularly the quote you cited about culture and institutions and shaping institutions, I wonder at what time Giddens was working on structuration, but that seems like what Granovetter wants to do as well, where, you know, let's say the under-socialized view would just be that people act based on pursuit of utility maximization. The over-socialized, or let me put it this way, this is perhaps a pithy way to put it, but the under-socialized view is that people are price takers. They just respond to that. The over-socialized view is that people are culture takers. They just respond to that. And this in-between view starts to lead up towards this middle ground of you're shaping and taking at the same time, you're acting on self-interest and at a social contract level, and there's multiple things happening. And so an added value is trying to look at people's kind of social pattern of social relationships. I see, Sarah, you've kind of let me know that Giddens was in 91. So probably a continuation of this strain of thought in between, you know, people just being price takers or just being culture takers versus a mix.
What I'm wondering is it almost that when one is a culture taker and one is a price taker changes according to the situation, and the social relations help with that. And that was partly what I was taking from the examples that he was given in that section in page 492. It's almost like the option of how you respond to a given stimulus, if there's an issue that, for example, and maybe these weren't the best examples, but like what would lean one in one instant to take a rational view or make a rational decision versus what would be a, you know, everybody else is doing a type of a decision. That sort of choice that one faces routinely is not necessarily whether to do something good or to do something bad, but just at any given time, you're making choices about whether to follow the crowd or not. And if the crowd is going in the Enron direction, then you wind up following the Enron direction if you're not careful. But that was what I took away from when he's talking about things being pursued by teams, is that there's in that middle ground, you're making decisions not based on grand views or grand, you know, grand morality or grand whatever. It's based on what's your buddy doing, what is your network doing, and whether or not you're going to go along with it or go against it, which in some cases is going to lead you towards a more economic path, and in other cases is going to lean you towards a more social path. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, and it kind of inspired another example in my mind, not used by Granovetter in this paper, but the added point I want to make with this example is that it doesn't even have to be when one or the other. It could be all kind of three layers acting at the same time. So if I take the example of, you know, suppose I was a smoker and I wanted to quit smoking, I could be making a rational decision based on my life goals. I want to be a father and a grandfather and I want to live long or whatever it is. And that's the under-socialized but atomistic utilitarian decision. I could be responding to, it's just gone out of the culture. It's not on TV anymore. It's not cool anymore. And I'm a passive recipient of that culture. So I'm no longer interested in smoking. And none of my friends perhaps smoke anymore either. So when I'm hanging out, I'm the only one. So which is that in between, the kind of who's the team, who's the group view. Now in a behavioral outcome like quitting smoking, it could, all three could reinforce each other as well. So it's not always when do we see which one playing a bigger role. It can even just be three kind of strata of analysis that are influencing this person's behavior.
But if we go back to the discussion of is it formal or informal institutions and relationships, which also then allows us to bring in the direct critique of Williamson's markets, which is the third part of this triangle, as we said, then you couldn't necessarily run those three levels at the same time unless you have a logic for what to do when they conflict. And this is the part of the paper that I think is the most useful, but isn't as developed for a formal logic, which is what to do if your social network, your cultural pressures, the things you're embedded with would lead you to a different result to the market, to this hierarchy, to the society. And you would have thought, given the examples of crime, that that would be a hard line, right? You would say, well, you do everything up until the line of crime. Oh, but then crime, you're out, right? Because you're out institutionally, you're out socially. Even if you're in a crime syndicate, he talks about finger pointing. So he talks about how the other criminals would also distance themselves from you, right? So you would think that crime would be the thing where the line would be drawn, but it's not as obvious. If you go back to the one that Tom brought up, the tipping in a faraway location, the economist goes on holiday and reflexively tips, even though there's no repeated transaction. There, when you have two logics that conflict, and you have a third one, actually, that's even more micro than Granovetter ever would have touched at, which is the sort of, am I a good person? Is this the kind of thing a good person does? And I'm momentarily forgetting the author of the what that is. We'll have to put it in after. And that's another level that this operates at. So then you have four levels, and we need to discuss the logic of how of what we think does happen when those levels conflict, and then more ideally, what do we think should happen if those levels conflict?
Yeah, I had one passage highlighted on 496, which sort of, notwithstanding the fact that he's trying to show, you know, trying to put this forth this argument about complaints about the fact that these idealized extremes and Williamson's model just simply don't show up in the real world. One of my biggest marks was on page 496 when he quotes Macaulay talking about how disputes are frequently settled without reference to the contract or potential or actual legal sanctions. There is a hesitancy to speak of legal rights or to threaten to sue in those negotiations, or as one businessman put it, you can settle any dispute if you keep the lawyers and accountants out of it. And that's a sort of like maybe this particular section is a fairly lengthy section that kind of gets at that one particular point about what the value proposition is for these social relations, if done right. And I guess, you know, maybe because the previous section was about trust and malfeasance, and that's been a wedge all the way through, he's also trying to show that, well, independent of what the result is, that here's kind of like a source of order, regardless of whether or not it's a good order or a corrupt order, but it's a sort of, it is a sign of how this order is captured through the social relations that allow a group to, when they have conflict, to resolve it in a way that doesn't necessarily follow any sort of legal authorities or rules. It's sort of like the under the table or the smoke-filled room of politics that was very much a metaphor used at the time.
Yeah, and I do think, firstly, I also really found that example thought-provoking, Tom, so I had it marked up as well in my reading. The idea of, you know, they might even refer to the contract, but not actually use it, but set it aside and have their own negotiation or the discussion. And I think that answers Sarah's point about Granovetter's view on kind of which of these, let's say, three approaches wins out. Let me also, as a quick loop back to another thing Sarah said about that fourth level where it's kind of this internalized, this act based on self-image or self-worth. That's actually something that's a little bit hidden in this paper, but he does refer to when he's referring to the Dennis Wrong AJS piece about the over-socialized view of man. So for Mark Granovetter, that fourth level that you were referring to, Sarah, is actually just not so much a level as an ironic meeting point of both the over-socialized and under-socialized that leads both to be atomized. And so what does it mean to say the over-socialized is still coming back to this like individual self-worth and utility? I quote from kind of page 483, where he is quoting that Dennis Wrong paper. So Dennis Wrong says, although sociologists have criticized past efforts to single out one fundamental motive in human conduct, the desire to achieve a favorable self-image by winning approval from others frequently occupies such a position. So the critique is that the over-socialized view assumes that your culture taking, because it also gives you the sense of kind of self-image and makes you feel like a good moral actor and such.
And actually, I was going to the reasonable man test of negligence in tort law. Is this what a reasonable person would do with this information in these circumstances? So even though it's individual and solving, like you said, then we have the cycle beginning again, because then we have the institution of law taking that on as a new standard.
Yeah, exactly. And then linking all of this back to where you left off, Tom, about that example where there's a contract, but people are just kind of negotiating the smoky room, smoke-filled kind of room metaphor. That suggests, and this is implicit, of course, that Granovetter might think that his third way wins out. So let's say in this example where there's a dispute, you know, between a buyer and a seller or between suppliers, the kind of economic thinking would be there's a contract in place, certain terms are triggered, so, you know, and you act based on what the contract says you should do. The over-socialized view would say that, okay, you resolve the dispute based on what everyone in the industry does. What's the norm in the industry whenever there's a dispute with a supplier? Granovetter's example is that, no, it's these two, buyer and supplier, know each other. They probably go to the same country club. And so they sit and kind of hash it out, regardless of the economics of the contract or the culture of the industry. So again, he doesn't say it explicitly, but that example emphasizes how this third path of just looking at the social relations in the kind of, you can almost see the network structure. It's an egocentric view and the social patterns around that and the interlocking of business ties, kinship ties, social ties are a good way to analyze and predict behavior.
Yeah, and it also raises a question about, transparency and some of the other things that are often presented as sort of, protections against malfeasance perpetrated in those closed circles. This may be where we can dive off into, part two application and kind of bringing it to the contemporary environment. There's obviously a thought process that says that way of doing business is seen as really, really high efficient and the way that we should be doing it versus that is just an inherently corrupt way of doing it. We need more transparency. We need to know more about how those deals are being made because we, whoever we are on the outside of those relations, are the victims of those of the decisions that come out. And so then you have, now we're bringing those two extremes back in as two views against what would be the embedded method of doing business and two views of saying why that method is flawed and corrupt or inherently corrupt or whatever. I don't think that's what he raises as, kind of like the outcome. He's mostly focused, Granovetter is mostly focused on exposing this this issue. But I think that was the logical conclusion that I drew after reading the paper to think about what do you sort of do with this idea? What do you do with this information? And I kind of saw that triangle, it's a source of continuous tension when you think about it, because once you settle on a particular path of viewing the world, the other two start to conspire against it. That was a takeaway anyway.
For me, I think that is a takeaway that I had, which perhaps speaks to my earlier thought about how if I were now analyzing a new case, entering a new setting, I would be looking at it from all those angles to get a sense of which one is at play, when, and why. And of course, we're not expecting Granovetter to do everything in one paper. And so this paper is just setting out that middle way and some suggestions about how to study it, but nothing really concrete. But the next question immediately becomes, which is better? Why the smoke-filled room is a great example. This is a tiny digression, but there's this book called How Democracies Die by these two political scientists at Harvard. It came out many years ago, but they make an interesting counterintuitive claim that the same gatekeepers in the literal smoke-filled rooms in, for example, the talk about a Democratic National Convention in the mid-20th century, and they pick one or two other such examples, those gatekeepers gatekept populists from kind of winning because they were like, okay, these aren't party veterans. They are rubbing people the wrong way in the establishment, even if they are appealing to the actual lay population. And so again, there's arguments on multiple sides of whether something is functional or not, and it depends on the context for sure. Perhaps before we jump into the Williamson part of it, it's worth kind of quoting one sentence from when he's closing out this section on trust, malfeasance, etc. Because I feel like that sentence is a summary of the point of the paper. And that's on page 493, where he says, "The embeddedness approach to the problem of trust and order in economic life, then, threads its way between the over-socialized approach of generalized morality and the under-socialized one of impersonal institutional arrangements by following and analyzing concrete patterns of social relations." So he tells us kind of how this one sits in between, and he also hints at how he thinks this would be studied, which of course ties in well with social network analysis, but the idea of following and analyzing concrete patterns of social relations.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. If so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch with us via LinkedIn, Facebook, X, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Also, please consider contributing to the program by buying us a coffee at www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. That's www.buyusacoffee.com/TAOP. Your support is greatly appreciated, as it allows us to continue providing great conversations about the classics of organization studies. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.